The wolf that one hears is worse than the orc that one fears.
True, but where the warg howls, there also the orc prowls.
Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, joined today by Will.
Hey.
Pat.
Hey, yeah.
And Jason, a.k.a. Aragorn.
Yo, let's do something epic.
Today, we're looking at The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, Part 2, the second half of the first book that it is known to many. So let's just jump right into it with this second half of the book. What stuck out to you in contrast to the movies or in contrast to what you're expecting or in your own journey, in your own hero's journey?
Well, I think as I was saying a minute ago, the biggest theme that stuck out to me that it was kind of hinted at during the Council of Elrond in the first half, that if they do succeed in their quest to destroy this great evil, that the elves are going to leave this world, and that even like no matter what, now it is cemented in the final outcome of this battle, the elves are going to leave for good or for evil, because their time on this earth is done, and either Middle Earth will succumb entirely to darkness, or that darkness will be eradicated and there will be no need for them, and it'll become the time of men and dwarves and halflings. And I found that interesting because it's not really made as prominent, I found, in the movies. Like, they are leaving, but they never really spelled it out, I found, that they're leaving because they must, and there's no other plan for them, and it's just their time now.
I think for me, it was probably the interaction with Boromir and Frodo when they're on the island. And it just reminds me of how one carries a heavy burden, like two people can carry a heavy burden, but one of them decides to deviate from their course and the other one stays on the course, but is filled with anxiety about how to move forward. And it's, I guess you can say it's similar to what millions of people have when it comes to making a change in their lives or making some kind of heavy change in their lives. They at first think that it's, you know, worth it, worth taking, but maybe halfway through they think, well, maybe I'm second guessing this. Maybe this is not a good idea. I think I should change my route to someplace else that is less, what would you call it? I guess less difficult. But the reward system is, you know, greater. And it just goes to show about how Boromir ends up becoming, you know, this, I don't want to say depressing character, but just, I would say, a hardened character, because he's so obsessed with bringing his homeland back together that he believes that this ring will help him with that. But so comes the, you know, grasping for power kind of ordeal that kind of turns into a different way, really.
Didn't his father send him specifically to Rivendell to try to capture this ring and bring it back?
It's certainly not made clear in the first book that that was the plan. He was just sent to seek counsel from Elrond, and it was happenstance. That's the way it's portrayed in the book.
But he rode to Rivendell like at a pretty fast pace, like not taking break. He just went straight there. I think something like 100 and something days across the land.
Yeah, 120.
Yeah, I think when you're just that desperate, if you're like, homeland is getting raided every day, and there's a glimmer of a chance of hope that you might get some help from the elves, you're gonna put all your eggs in that basket, I suppose. So, you know, it started off, I think, as just him looking for help in whatever form that manifested in, and then he just figured it out that, oh, the ring might be able to help me. So I'm just going to start focusing on that. And then the ring started to possess him a little bit. So that will to power started to manifest in our boy Boromir.
Well, the ring, isn't it drawn towards the darker side? So it's like Boromir's father wants this ring, and it's almost like the ring is trying to get to him through Boromir. Because, you know, if the ring gets to his father, it's most likely going to be easier for it to get back to Mordor or Sauron and not end up in the pits to melt. Yeah, like
when he gave the nine rings to the realms of men, that created the ring wraiths that made servants for him. So the one ring on just another random king, he'd definitely be able to take him over. And just say, hey, that's mine, by the way. Give me back my ring and your kingdom is spared. You can rule over the ashes of whatever's left when I'm done with it.
Yeah, it's kind of like making a short-term deal with the devil. Like, you'll get your kingdom saved, but ultimately, in the long term, you end up losing.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you wonder if we're seeing the nobleness and the wisdom of Frodo in his decisions that he makes, that he realizes he can't trust anyone and he understands the vastness of this burden, and he's totally prepared to run away on his own and not get anyone else mixed up with it, because it has to be destroyed and there's only one way to deal with this and all other paths lead to destruction. Or is it just his own fear and him doing what he thinks has to be done because of what he's been told by, you know, the advisors at the council? And is he even making his own choice? And does he see it to be his own choice? Or is he feeling that he's bound up in this story of fates and destinies that's been influenced upon him by the elves and the wizards, the Maiar, and so on and so forth?
And even the ring. I mean, when you're reading the book, anyway, for me, it kind of presents that, like, oh, the ring is getting to him. It's not just that whole event with Boromir that said, I can't trust the fellowship. I think he was just like, the ring almost gave him an opening to say, I can't trust anybody, so just go on my own. I think that's what Sauron probably wants more than anything, is to say that, well, he's alone, he'll be easier to pick off now, but he wasn't counting on Sam following him, so the real hero of the Lord of the Rings.
Well, and Sam's just as hungry for the ring too, right? Like, that's why he's going after Frodo. He wants that power for himself. He just doesn't voice it. Oh, yeah, it's got to be... Like, he can't even swim. He jumps in the water and he's going to drown. Like, that's what he's willing to put on the table to be near the ring and Frodo.
I see you're working on your Darkest Timeline fan fiction.
It's non-negotiable for Sam. He says to Frodo, I'll destroy all of these boats and neither of us will leave this bank, or I'm coming with you. And Frodo laughs it off, thinking, oh, Sam's so supportive. But little does he know what's going to happen on the steps.
That's a good point.
I like how this is playing out. I like that there was, like, one little mention of Tom Bombadil in the Council of Elrond. She's like, hey, what if we just get Tom Bombadil to come help us? And Gandalf's just like, he's busy. He won't help us.
He'd put it in a drawer and forget about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's the question of, well, couldn't they have just given the ring to one of the eagles, like, taken the easy way? But I think that doesn't get to the point of, you know, the importance of carrying the burden of the ring. You know?
Yeah.
I think it would have probably corrupted the eagles too. I mean, imagine one of those eagles flying around with ring wraith powers. That'd be pretty terrifying. I don't think they'd want to take that risk.
So maybe sometimes the easy way is also too risky.
And the thing is, like, the eagles aren't in a position to leave their region. Like, they're protecting it and you know, the Bjornings are also protecting that land, and the masses of armies are gathering on all hills and on all fronts. And if an eagle was to fly directly into Mordor, it would just get shot down because it's at its strongest it's been in thousands of years. And it's not until the armies are pulled out and distracted and the eyes facing Minas Tirith that, you know, Frodo was able to get his opening to sneak in. And then after the army's destroyed, you know, we get that rescue. But who knows what actually happens in the books, right? Like, that's just the movies.
There's one little throwaway line while they were still in Rivendell too, where it was either Merry or Pippin, where he said, like, "All hail Frodo, the Lord of the Ring." And Gandalf is like, "Shut up, stupid. He's not the Lord of the Ring. Don't even say that. Don't make that joke here." What'd you think about that part?
Well, it was a little hypocritical because Gandalf speaks in the tongue of Mordor, right? Like, talk about saying he who must not be named. Like, you're literally speaking his language.
Yeah.
I did like how Merry and Pippin joined the Fellowship without really knowing what they were getting into. And say, no matter what, we're down, we're going.
Yeah. They talk about, "Oh, well, there's two more spots open. I'll find someone in my family," like Elrond is saying. "I'll find the best, believe me." And then Pippin and Merry are like, "No, then where are we going to sit? What do you mean?" "Wherever Frodo goes, we go."
The Fellowship was like 30 seconds away from having Glorfindel and Arwen join them and just completely destroy all things.
Yeah. Think about how differently it might have played out if it was Glorfindel there with them.
I can't believe they turned Glorfindel into Arwen. I don't think we even really brought that up in the last recording.
Oh, I don't think so.
But it was like, that's not Arwen. What's going on?
Yeah. The Lord of the Rings is complicated.
It was a lot different. Like, the movie was good, and it was a completely different story. Like I was saying to my wife, they basically took the first chapter and maybe 20 pages throughout the middle and then the last four chapters, and they were like, "Here you go." Oh, and then a chapter from the next book.
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't mention Tom Bombadil in the movie, but I must have missed that. Arwen and Glorfindel, I thought they were two completely different actresses.
Glorfindel's a guy.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm thinking of Galadriel.
Yeah. Galadriel is Arwen's mom, technically.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why when Galadriel's like, "What would you like as a gift to Aragorn?" He's like, "You already know what I want."
Yeah.
"Your daughter." It's not yours to give.
The one part that I really liked was Bilbo giving his sword and his elven armor off to Frodo. That was a wholesome little scene. Like, here you go. Take Mithril. Yeah.
That was directly after he asked to see the ring, or was it right before?
I'm not sure. It was around the same time, though.
Yeah.
I think it was in the same conversation. But, like, yeah, it must have been after, because that's when you realized, like, okay, my adventuring days are behind me. I really shouldn't have asked to look at the ring. Take all my stuff. Everyone thinks this is, you know, wasting away collecting dust in a museum, but you take it with you, Frodo. Just passing on the torch.
I mean, a second ago, Will, you were talking about Frodo's decision to, like, voluntarily accept the burden of the ring. And it kind of feels like he is doing this out of love for the Shire. And as if he doesn't really have a choice, he feels that if he doesn't do it, that his world is just going to be burned to a cinder.
I don't know if I even get that, right? Like, because in The Hobbit, you know, there's every 50 pages Bilbo says, "And he yearned for his hobbit hole and his place by the fire and a warm meal." But we don't get that from Frodo. We just get anxiety and dread and just a complete non-negotiable belief that he has to carry this ring. And it happened pretty quickly, probably around the time that they took a shortcut to mushrooms. And he discovered what it was that was chasing him. And he knew that he was going to be taking the ring before they got to Rivendell. And he knew that he was going to be leaving them before they got to Anduin. Like, he, at some point, just an entire character shift happened. And it was probably just when he received the ring and started to learn what it was with Gandalf in the fire, right? But I don't see him doing this as a noble thing to protect his land, because he doesn't return to his land either, right? He sees it as this is his duty, his service, his karma. And it's not even about what comes after, and there's no planning the future and protecting loved ones. It's just, this is a must for him.
Yeah, and he even, you know, he takes it a bit further after meeting Galadriel. And that scene where he looks into that, you know, water well.
Mirror.
The mirror.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he becomes something more and something less than a halfling the moment he put the ring on in the Prancing Pony, right? Every time he's put the ring on, he's, and when he got stabbed too by the Nine, the King of the Nine, he started to get different eyes for the world. He started to get different senses, and we see that. That's what we get every 50 pages. We get, he senses the darkness around him. He feels the presence of darkness. He is vastly aware of the sounds that couldn't possibly be an echo and are just barely audible. And he sees something in the eyes that aren't told on the face. And it's a different world view that he develops. He sees the ring on Galadriel's hand, Enya, before, and actually in spite of anybody. Nobody sees the ring. It's masked by her own subtle magics.
Hey, you're not supposed to talk about that ring.
Sorry. This is history. She's dead. It's gone.
Oh, man. Yeah, I like how you put that. Like, step by step, Frodo gets another vision of, like, what the chaos around him really looks like. It's just like, okay, now I see the King of the Nine Ringwraiths for and it's what, like, he is. And he's, like, putting his knife through me. It's painful to have that world revealed over and over and over again. He's just like, I can't keep everyone else around me, because they're gonna have the same twisted revelations as I'm having, and that's dangerous if we're gonna have to beat the Dark Lord in the end.
Well, and it's like, so you buy a new car and then you see that car everywhere, and you know, it becomes part of your identity, and your unconscious mind puts that data into your reticular activation system, which allows you to filter content at a million bytes per second. You only get 8, and one of those things is now this thing that's part of your identity. But for Frodo, he got the ring, and his identity manifested, and what he started to see was evil and absolute must and certainty and decision beyond decision, choice beyond choice, absolute path and no other options, no opportunity, no goodness, no hope, no despair, just anxious will to complete the quest that is in his mind, who he is. He becomes the quest to destroy the ring and less himself, and he loses himself to the quest. And we do this every day, 9 to 5, when we tell ourselves we have to go to work and make money, and it's non-negotiable, and we get out of bed and we kick ourselves in the ass and we fire up our anxiety machine and we chug a coffee and run out the door to work and get to payday. But this man embarks on the journey of a lifetime.
Yeah, and do you feel he's taking this on without a sense of resentment towards it? Like, he has to do it, and he's gonna do it the best he can without, like, cursing under his breath.
Well, it's like, there's no written dogma, but he's embraced a dogma, and he's sacrificed his individuality to serve this higher purpose. And it's not structured or defined, and it's not written in a book, but it has been created through the gestalt of his experiences and his interactions with these wise advisors. And that's just what happens. He completely leans in and he loses himself. And he becomes more.
Yeah, he's listening to the demon inside of him. Like Socrates.
Yeah.
Leaning into the dark side in order to defeat the dark side.
It's just like, and I use the word dogma just to irk you, right, Scott? But it's like, he's walking in the way, right? He's a servant of Lord of the Ring and the yeah. true quest of the ring and the fate of the world and the destiny of the purpose. And he knows what has to be done, and he accepts that and he does it. And he spends some time contemplating it, but he always knows what needs to be done.
So do you think he made the right choice in abandoning the Fellowship or breaking apart the Fellowship? Do you think that if all nine stuck together, that eventually like Legolas and Gimli and Aragorn would pull the same stunt that Boromir did? Something like that?
No, I don't think it was about that. I think he could have trusted Legolas, Gimli, and Aragorn, and Merry, and Pippin, and Sam, and even Boromir to the end. Because Boromir catches himself, right? And we see the pity of Boromir at the end. And Boromir would go to Gondor no matter what. And Aragorn would make that choice no matter what. And Legolas and Gimli would want to make that choice, but they'd want to protect the halflings. And so the way it unfolds, at least in the movie, is how it had to unfold, even if there wasn't that conflict. And if they had have gone together and followed Gollum and been to the spider cave, they would have killed the spider. And Frodo would have come out unscathed, and then they would have got to the guard tower, and then they would have been killed. But that's not how it played out. It was a sneaky, sneaky effort with a bit of fate, destiny, luck, and divine intervention, most likely. There was only one path for all of them.
Yep.
I mean, the author, he's writing this from the perspective of having gone through World War I, where at the same time, you know, it's like there's one path in this war. You're either going to pick up your gun and fight, you know, with other people, but entering into that game is a dangerous proposition. You know, when you pick up a gun, you're very likely to get yourself hurt in the process,
and you risk more pain to those you love by not picking up the gun, and you become honor stricken and duty bound, and you become more than yourself, and you pick up the cause and you go to battle, not because you want to, not because you look forward to it, but because you only see one way of resolving this thing and fighting this evil force, and that it would be just as destructive to risk putting that burden on others. And it is the combined effort of everyone, and each has their role.
And I guess that's where the anxiety begins to fill in. And it's also, you know, a good thing, really. It's essentially, you know, picking you up off your bootstrap and start going. Like, it's telling you, go, 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 go. Otherwise, if you stay here, you're dead.
Yeah, and that's all there is, right? Survival and procreation.
Yeah.
There's got to be more to it than that. Survival and procreation.
That is how anxiety works. That's the fight or flight. That we are more than that, but that's how that part of our brain does stuff. It says, I'm processing this data, and I suggest to you that these are things to worry about in the near, medium, and long-term futures. And, you know, we have to process stress properly and not have mental breakdowns like Boromir does, and unlike Frodo doesn't get through that list of negatives. You know, we need to be able to take the data that our survival brain gives us and then use our knowledge brain to formulate the best path. And if we do it right and we get into a state of flow like Frodo does, you're running down the hill away from danger and you're doing the thing right away, because otherwise you're just thinking about it. And thinking is a very stagnant action.
And you would hit rock bottom if you did the opposite. So
maybe, or you could just get stuck in the mire. You don't have to hit rock bottom to be in a swamp of uselessness that becomes gaseous and toxic and useless.
You could, but in a way, I mean, you could end up being stuck there forever and just accepting your fate.
Because for me, rock bottom wouldn't be being upset and anxious and depressed. Rock bottom would be like acting in the wrong way and fighting against the current and digging deeper into the muck and damaging those closest to you and pushing away those that are around you, right? Like Frodo's not at rock bottom. Boromir wasn't at rock bottom either. They were dealing with conflicts in themselves and confusions in themselves and receiving support. But if and when Sam kills everyone around him and hops on a Nazgul, and that's rock bottom. That's operating out of an evil, unchecked force. And yeah, that it'll grind you down.
Yeah, thinking about like Frodo's escape as like the flow state, it kind of reminds me of like our old conversation about the difference between, you know, flow and dark flow, or light flow and dark flow. So what do you think? I tend to lean towards Frodo's going through some dark flow right now, in the sense that he's not necessarily making the wrong decisions because of it, but I don't think he is perfectly embodying that area between anxiety and boredom. But he's just kind of pushing through regardless.
Well, and it was like, thank goodness Sam had the reason to join him, right? Because if Frodo had just gotten to the other side without anyone, he would have been dead in a week.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's like light flow allows interdependence and support and opportunity, right? And hope. But dark flow's got tunnel vision.
Yeah, it was dark flow that pushed him away on his own, and light flow that let Sam come with him.
Because he's like standing in scarcity, fear, and survival, and tunnel vision.
Yeah.
And some of that is necessary. Some of that is true, but it doesn't help. It's like our quote at the beginning, right? The warg that is near is more of a threat than the great existential threat of an army of orcs that you don't see.
Yeah. I caught a lot of like foreshadowing too. Like part of me was like, man, I wish I didn't know how a lot of this turned out, because like that Gandalf moment's pretty heavy in the book. And then it's just like, well, we gotta keep going. Gandalf's gone. He told us to fly. That's what we're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason this was probably one of the best-selling books. If you can imagine having been one of the first readers of it when it first came out, you'd be on the edge of your seat.
Mm-hmm. I kind of kind of reminds me of Star Wars Episode 5, where it's like, when you go to watch the original Star Wars trilogy, one of the things that you absolutely know going in is Darth Vader's Luke's father. That's the line everybody knows. No, I am your father. So like that doesn't hit as hard when, you know, you don't, when you know what's coming.
You know, I do like this metaphor of rock bottom in relation to the Mines of Moria, because they are going through the Misty Mountains, correct? And they encounter impassable weather, and they have to make the choice. Well, you know, we have to go forward, and there's the option of going down into the mines, which we might not come out of. We might hit rock bottom there. And ultimately, Gandalf kind of does. He ends up going down that pit, wherever it leads to. Mm-hmm. And the rest of them, they kind of wade through the remainder of the mine and escape, but they don't let the aspect of the threat around them like freeze them into a state of like paralysis.
Like, so I just want to say this is how I feel, but I think If Boromir had have taken the ring, that would have been rock bottom for Boromir. And if they had have gotten stuck in the mines of Moria, they would have been stuck. They wouldn't have been at rock bottom. They would have just been in a really terrible spot. And I think we're conflating the two concepts of, being stuck between a rock and a hard place versus rock bottom. Because you can go years being stuck and it's not destructive, it's just not productive, right? And it's like if you stopped
It's
being
stagnant.
stuck, you could see how much good you could make. But if you're at rock bottom, you're literally actively involved in the destruction of your own integrity. And that's what would have happened if Boromir got the ring. And that's the way I see it. I see rock bottom as like truly an evil place where you're in dark flow and satisfying the ego and sacrificing the higher states of being without dogma.
I kind of like the idea of this light flow versus dark flow, but I tend to think of it in terms of like the viscosity of the flow. So I'll think of dark flow as like sticky flow, where you get stuck in a particular pit, or you're just stuck and it's hard to get out of there. Whereas light flow is like a there's nothing in your path that's stopping you. You feel like you're
Bubbling,
flying.
bubbling, and a spiraling, and an enlightening sort of flow.
So there was this thought experiment I was kind of doing while reading this, and the idea of if there were two rings and you gave one to an unjust person like Sméagol, and you gave one to a just person like Bilbo or Frodo, like will that power corrupt the just person and turn them into the Gollum?
Well, I kind of have something to say, but you guys are gonna be disappointed that I had to bring it back to a comic book reference. I'm even wearing my Captain America t-shirt today, and it's relevant because, Steve Rogers, Captain America, he was like a meek, pathetic guy. They gave him the super soldier serum, and he became like all of that good in him got amplified, and he became a real righteous superhero. But then, someone like the John Walker, the Captain America who comes up later on, he gets the superhero super soldier serum, and he turns into a crazy anti-hero vigilante, takes everything into his own hands. He lets the power corrupt him, so he just wasn't ready for it. But like someone who truly understands what power is and has value for it won't let it corrupt them. That's my opinion.
Okay, but like, what if the ring is a metaphor for communism, right? Like, if the tool of power is inherently flawed, assuming communism is flawed, let's not even say communism, let's just call it dictatorship, just totalitarian dictatorship. That's what the ring is a metaphor for. Absolute wrong. And it's built from it. You can't take power and say it isn't inherently bad if it's born of inherently badness and then use it for good. It'd be like saying, well, lightning bolts coming out of your fingertips isn't inherently bad, so I'm going to learn the dark side of the force and use it for good. Because it's like you can't, because it will corrupt you because it's evil. You'd be like, well, slavery isn't inherently like, yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like if the ring
Because it's
has
not $1 million. It's not a metaphor for money. It's not a metaphor for steel and army. It's.
Yeah, if you
So I was
use.
just thinking that, well,
Yeah.
like what if the ring were a metaphor for money, and like in a society where you trade money, the unjust person has a slight advantage because they're willing to do things that a just person wouldn't, and they typically come out with more money.
I can't speak to that because I don't have the numbers. And I'd like to believe that there are more variables at play than just the unjust individual taking advantage of a loophole, right? Because that's like, we try and make laws in a way that they don't get taken advantage of, but obviously the system isn't perfect, because if it was perfect, we'd all be dead and we'd be gods. And that's not what we're doing. We're humans and we're trying to improve, and we're on Earth. But
yeah, I think the
bigger problem is the bystanders, right? Like, there's the people that would use power for good, and there's the people that you would use power for evil. And then there's the people that are not even interested in being part of the discussion, that don't want to vote, that don't want to volunteer, that don't want to debate, that don't want to believe that the person that is speaking has something of value to say, that are just not engaged and are running their shoe store in Minas Tirith, hoping someone else solves the problem for them.
Yeah, I think you hit on something really important on, like, the ring isn't just a symbol for just raw power, like a superhero, super soldier serum, right? It's more like the ring is the metaphor for, like, the throne over the entire world, where everyone has to bow. And that in and of itself is evil. Because if you put even the most, even if Galadriel or Gandalf was given that seat, eventually it wouldn't work as well, because, you know, what we've learned from Marcus Aurelius, the world is maintained by change. You can't just have one person on the throne of the world and expect them to make the right decision for everyone at every point in time. It just doesn't work that way. Then when Tolkien presents the ultimate goal as destroying the ring, like getting rid of that whole throne symbology in general, you know, it's almost an argument for libertarianism, or at least smaller.
I thought you might go there.
At least smaller, like, states, you know, not just one empire ruling the entire planet in a one world utopia. It makes a lot more sense for, you know, maybe not for no one to have that power, but for, like, a multitude of people to have an equal amount of power to be able to have those conversations, and then a more stabilized hierarchy in place. I don't want to smash the hierarchy. I want to rearrange it a little bit, evolve it, include a bit more people step by step.
Well, and the trouble is, like, so in the beginning, you know, Sauron himself wasn't inherently evil. It was the three were made for the elves in the dwarven mines of Moria, I believe, or Region. But I think it was in the dwarven mines.
All I know is Celebrimbor had something to do with it. He made the rings.
And when those were created, I think that great power caused the reflection, right? Because you look at their use over the years, and 9 times out of 10, Galadriel doesn't let you know that she has it and doesn't use it. And that's, like, so what is even the point of having it? And so because it was manifested, you know, Sauron got greedy and hungered for the control of the power and made the mirror of that great power. Because, again, you can't have freedom if you have ultimate power and it's held by a great leader too, right? Like, the power, as you're saying, has to be divided through the people. You have to have your own autonomy, and if we're stuck following the rules and it's the only way we know, we're going to naturally want to rebel to explore our ignorance, because that's how we evolve. Not because it makes sense to, but because we cycle through this. And I think that the destruction of the One Ring isn't sort of this, like, moral of saying we need to get rid of, you know, high seats of government. It's we need to get rid of places of corrupt power, and we need multiple parties involved doing everything they can all over the world, fighting on all fronts to have any chance of having a good lasting peace.
Yeah. I like that a lot. It's like the whole world kind of has to unite through their own values to, you know, find what's worth fighting for and what's worth maintaining. And it's worth maintaining that, you know, that throne at the top of the pedestal, at the top of the pyramid, doesn't get filled. Like, yeah. When I read about the founding fathers, like, I'm not American at all, but, like, when I think of the founding fathers, like, they were onto something because they knew that, you know, it doesn't matter who's in charge. We're all human. Someone's going to mess up at some point. And, you know, more than 4 years or more than 8 years, that's just not a good idea in any way.
Well, they were very careful in selecting what kind of system works and what doesn't work. And that's why the first four founding fathers were always together and just discussing, okay, how can we, during the whole, you know, British settlement era, how can we, as new Americans, not form a tyrannical system, but just to provide equal opportunity for everybody? And that was a very, very hard and long enduring process. It took them years to do that, and lots of debating and lots of fighting, and a lot of people were killed during that time, but eventually they had to settle on what was good, what was the best. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's not perfect, but it works.
They're still working on it too, right? Like,
yeah,
that's the whole notion of passing on the torch as well. I think it'd be silly to think that because the system has flaws, that the system is broken, and that because the system has benefits, that it doesn't need improving. And I think that what happens is we get a lot of people in that middle ground where they're not emotionally charged and emblazoned by the rhetoric of their opinions, but they're just not even thinking that they can make a contribution and affect any sort of grand change in the world. I'm sure now even more than ever, right, with the pandemic, like, we're in a stay-at-home, state of emergency, lockdown, no outdoor gatherings. For a minute we had playgrounds. You couldn't even play on a playground, and cops were being told that they were going to get power to stop and question people and see if they lived in the town that they were driving around in and send them home and charge them $750. And the cops immediately said, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, but every police force in our province of Ontario is like, are you nuts? Nope. Just,
like, because when you say we're going to charge you $750 for being out of your town, it's a threat to poor people, and they're not leaving their town, so they don't have anything to worry about. And it's not threatening to uber rich, and they're probably not sick because they're uber rich. But the middle class, you know, the deterrent of $750, like, how many times can you budget that in a year? Maybe 3 times in a year? You got to be very specific about traveling. But that is the problem we're experiencing. And I was pretty sure this is what we've been asking for, right? Was a town like Huntsville shouldn't have any cases. A town like Penetang shouldn't have any cases. But we get people coming from hot zones and spreading the virus because they want to go to their cottage and they want to be on the lake and they want to isolate in the bush. And it's like, that's not how it works.
Yeah, I just want common sense. Like, I think I just expect too much from people.
Yeah, it's a little different over here in the States because we had, you know, similar lockdowns, maybe not quite as strict, but now we're seeing almost like a rebound effect where everybody was told to stay home, and now everything's almost opened up. So people are traveling, they're getting out of their house, you know, as if they were like ants and their hive was on fire.
Well, and it's like, I see in Canada right now, the behavior of Boromir at the end of this book, where they're saying, we need the vaccines, we need all the vaccines, we're doing a terrible job, and we have this tool that can end this war and give it to us. And we're 22% of our population's received our first dose. We're freaking out about this South African variant, and the continent of Africa has 0.75% of the population dosed. And we're saying, we need this thing, and it's going to help us, and it's going to make everything okay. And we're not thinking about how it will impact the rest of the world. We're not dividing the vaccines up equally across third world nations and considering how, you know, the One Ring being in the hands of Boromir would impact the dwarves and the halflings and the eagles and the Bjornings. It's just this nationalistic fervor around vaccinating our population as quick as possible. And nobody's even talking about how many vaccinations we need. We're at 3.5 million doses given to our residents in Ontario. And there's 15 million of us. 3.5 million over 15 million is 20%. Like, are we dosing the whole population? I feel like there's a big percentage of the population that isn't supposed to receive a dose because they can't. And then there's the percentage of the population that's gotten sick and recovered. And if they recovered, doesn't that mean they're immune? Because if they're not immune, wouldn't they still be sick or dead? So what's that percentage of the population that's recovered and immune, plus the percentage of the population that's vaccinated, plus the percentage of the population that's not getting vaccinated? How many more millions of doses do we need? Because if it's 15 million doses and we're doing 100,000 a day, which we are and have been, we'll be done in 5 months. And in 5 months, you can't even get to Rivendell. Like, the journey hasn't even started in 5 months. You're telling me we need to go faster? Like, what are you defining as taking a long period of time? Because 7 years just went by really quick for me. And you're telling me 5 months isn't enough time? We're a year ahead of schedule.
Man, Frodo waited for years in the Shire before he left. He's waiting for some sign, waiting for Bilbo's birthday, whatever it was. Like, it's important.
Waiting for Gandalf to come back.
Yeah, it's important to, like, have patience in these kind of situations more than anything. It's like, okay, maybe we're missing the mark of where we could be, but that doesn't mean we're, you know, not doing anything. Like, we might not have reached our potential, but we're still outperforming, like you said, the Cape of Africa, right?
Yeah, the entire continent, all of Africa, 0.75%.
It makes me laugh. I was talking to you, Will, the other day, and I'm just like, dude, our province is effed. And you're like, no. You know what province is effed? Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq. And you just kept listing them off.
I'm like, China.
Okay, fair enough. Fair
North
enough.
Korea.
Okay, you've made your point. Okay, yes, I was a bit extreme with my language. All right.
Siberian tundra. country you've never heard of in South America.
Yeah.
And 10 more down there.
It's worth putting those things in perspective sometimes, and, you know, it's worth
St. Vincent, where a volcano is currently erupting and their population is being evacuated because their homes are being burned down.
And you're stuck in your basement.
Oh, you're alive? Good. And it's like the other notion that everybody's screaming about up here is paid sick leave. And we have a federal benefit program for paid sick leave. And I got into it yesterday with my sister because she completely misinterpreted me and got triggered. But I was like, if you're not in a position where you can't defer your rent payment, which has been acknowledged at the federal and provincial levels that, like, you're not getting, like, in Canada, you don't get to have things that are necessary for your life taken away from you because you don't have money immediately. That's not how it works.
Right.
And if you're not in a position to take a hit to your credit for a month or 2 months because you have to take some time off of work, there's something else bigger going on that paid sick leave would just as well equally not address. If the difference of minimum wage, $14 an hour, 4 hours a shift, because apparently you're working multiple part times, so $120 a day, seven times, we're talking $1,000. If $1,000 will starve you to death, paid sick leave is not the solution that we need to make for you. And we should make a solution for you. But don't tell me that we don't have paid sick leave. Because if you're on the edge of dying every day, and if you miss one shift or a week's worth of work, there is a way bigger problem. And it's been here since before the pandemic. And you're lying to me.
It kind of reminds me that, you know, we're focused on this vaccine, which is a good tool in our toolbox, but, you know, what are we doing to address prevention of other pandemics from arising, right? If, bringing it back to the story, if the orcs were transmitting the plague or some kind of goblin syphilis to the people of the Shire, like, sure, having a vaccine might be good, but you might want to also consider, like, trying to get rid of the orcs or the goblins.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Like, so every day I drive to work, I drive past a sign sponsored by McDonald's that says, never drive impaired. And I was explaining this to my friend the other day. I was like, so all you're doing is focusing on the fact that there are impaired drivers. And now you're creating awareness of the fact that it is a thing that we know about, that people drive impaired. Whereas you could have said, there are impaired drivers, be safe. And given a positive doing. Instead, you're giving me thou shalt nots. And why would you give me a thou shalt not? Are you just short-sighted, or are you completely ignorant of the fact that if you gave me a thou shall or thou could, that I would have more awareness of things to do? The first time I learned about drugs was through DARE in high school. And all they told me to do was that they're terrible, they make you feel great, and don't do them.
Just say no.
And then, like, when you get older, they say, you need to take different drugs.
Well, but it's exactly, for one thing. But on the other hand, it's like, why would you have a school program that says don't do drugs? And that's the only exposure you're going to give me. Like, why wouldn't you have a do volunteering, do sports, experience meditation, experience yoga. Let's go for a walk. Let's create art. Like, why would you give me a thou shalt not and not tell me how to live a good human experience? Like, do you not have any advice? Like, if you fight something with this branding, you lose through your own devices. The war on drugs makes more drugs. The war on terrorists makes more terrorists. The war on mental health makes more mental health issues. Reactive, it's not preventative. Like Boromir.
Yeah, it kind of like, it's kind of ties into the decision of, well, what if we just gave the ring to Tom Bombadil and just let him keep it in a drawer? Well, sure, you're fixing the problem of Sauron doesn't get the ring, but you're not fixing the problem of the Dark Lord is literally at the gates of Gondor and, you know, the Misty Mountain and still trying to take over the world. You're just delaying the inevitable. You have to find the root of the problem and take it on, head forward, just face it on.
And it's the same thing with your goblin syphilis question, Jason. You know, like, if you can't stop yourself from having sex with goblins that have syphilis, like, maybe the only thing you know about is having sex with goblins that have syphilis. And it's like, perhaps you could flow. Maybe read a book. Maybe go for a walk. Maybe learn how to make some mushroom soup. But you can't force a horse to drink water, but you can certainly show them where the trough is.
Yeah, that's good. A minute ago, we were talking about the creation of the ring. And do you guys feel that it's similar to a Horcrux from, you know, yes, the Harry Potter stories? I thought so, too.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where Rowling got a lot of her ideas was Tolkien. Let's be honest. For a lot of writers, that's the case.
And so Tolkien may have gotten this idea from much earlier legends. Like, I was reading this Testament of Solomon, where he has a ring that allows him to control demons. It's got a pentagram engraved on it, and when he puts this ring on, whatever he writes some rings down, like a too. commandment, the demon he's addressing must follow that.
Like King Solomon of David.
Yeah, yeah. King Solomon,
the guy with the temple. You know,
he's got a ring. So I want Aaron's chest plate. I want Moses' staff. I want Solomon's ring. We're going to build a suit of biblical armor.
I want Joshua's sword, too. Joshua's the one that brought down Jericho with the edge of his sword. But yeah, the Eddas here, the Prose Edda and Poetic Edda, both have some fables about rings in them as well. The dwarven made relics and all of that. There was another part where, like, associated with Galadriel, they said that they met her at the high place. And I was wondering if there was a little connection between that and, like, the Asherah of the Bible that we see, of, like, the either Canaanite or Philistine deity always located at the high place.
Is the high place where Frodo looks into the mirror?
Yeah, I think so.
It was like Will saying no.
Yeah, I thought they went into a dip.
Maybe, but like when they first met Galadriel, it wasn't after. It might not have been when he actually had the vision, but it was like when they go to meet her the first time, and it was the whole party,
rather than just. Oh, when they climb up the ladder in the Maelorn tree, and they go to the top flat of the elves.
Yeah. It was just the language of the high place. Like Galadriel was at the high place. They went to the highest point, and that's where she was. So it was just the wording that stuck out to me. It was like, that's the same wording my King James Bible uses, so.
Well, there's something intrinsically good about a high place, you know? You get the supervision of your land, and that's the place to really be.
Yeah.
Speaking of religious symbology, I thought that the mirror that they look into is very similar to, like, the Buddhist Wheel of Life, where you see this demon looking over the wheel. He's actually looking into a mirror and seeing a reflection of himself and all of the changing that's constantly going on within him.
I thought you were going to say it reminded you of Harry Potter again.
The little memory pool in Dumbledore's closet.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Like that's what I thought of immediately. I guess I just know Harry Potter a little bit better than Lord of the Rings, but I've read those books before, so this is a first for me, so it's been a pretty good experience.
It's kind of like the magic mirrors in, I don't know if you guys have seen The Tenth Kingdom. I think it was a like straight to TV movie. It was like 7 hours long, and it's based on all of the Disney stories, sort of, and the Grimm fairy tales, but there's this entire kingdom of all of the stories and fairy tales. They all exist throughout this massive land, and you know, the evil witch has these mirrors, and if you've got a mirror and you're looking into the mirror and it's one of the ones for seeing, she can see you looking at her, and it's like sort of divining ability that the evilness can still see through.
Well, so this story, this book ends with the fellowship breaking up and Frodo is setting out on his own with Sam, but what's coming up from what you guys can remember for the next book? It's
The Two Towers. We've got the Ent War at Isengard, where Merry and Pippin are abducted by dumb orcs. And
they're taking the hobbits to Isengard.
To Isengard! Tell me, where is Gandalf? For I very much desire to speak with him.
All right, but we don't want to get into too many spoilers. I mean, if you haven't watched the movies, though, I don't know where you've been all this time.
20th anniversary year, right?
You know, some people make it a ritual to read these books once a year.
Yeah, I could believe it. If you could have a book that you read every year, what would it be?
It would have to be something that resonates with you.
I'm tempted to go with Meditations.
The Art of War was pretty good. I'm going to lend it to my sister this week. She thought it was huge, and I was like, no, it's tiny.
Yeah.
I'd have a hard time deciding, but these fantasy novels would probably be somewhere near the top of that list.
Like maybe even The Legends of King Arthur. I have them here. Arthur and the Holy Grail and Tristan. That, like, just something with the hero's journey, really. The Odyssey was great.
There's just so much to read. I never want to just, oh, but I've already read that one before. Let me go on to something different, you know?
Yeah, it's great to read a book that you like, you know, more than once.
Yeah.
Rediscover it.
I do that with comic books. I do that with comic books.
My sister, when Harry Potter first came out, didn't know there was a second book. She read the first book like 17 times, like to the point that the cover was like wearing and tearing. And then she found out about the rest of them and she's like, oh.
That's funny. I think we've just
final
about,
points?
Yeah, I think we've just about exhausted our resources here What do you guys think?
Yeah.
Well, I'm ready to pick up the next book.
All right.
Me too.
Then till next time, we have a podcast on Anchor, Spotify, Google Play, all the good places. We're on YouTube, got a website at www.bookwave.club. And check us out and like, follow, subscribe, share with all your friends and family. May the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
May you shine with the light of Intriel.